So thanks very much for coming. This is the opening of our sixth communications seminar. As you can see on the program, every morning we have a lecture from 10 to 10.30. Of course, that's 10 to 11.30. Just a little mistake. So we're opening up with a lecture by Ravindra Swarup Prabhu, titled Faith and Knowledge. And each of his lectures is a progression on the last one. He's doing three lectures in the seminar. Just before we open, I'd like to introduce you to the ISKCON Communications Journal, issue number 3. The inside is very well done in Latvia, but the cover didn't come out so well. But anyway, Padma Malini Devi will be selling them outside at the end of every lecture. There'll be a table out there so you can pick them up. So now I'd just like to go straight into introducing Ravindra Swarup.
I'll raise my own blackboard.
I'll do that.
Okay, go ahead. Talk.
So you all know Ravindra Swarup Prabhu. Next, we're going to have Sri Raswami and Naveen Krishna, Managers' Relationships with Devotees. That's at 11:45. It's actually very, very important that everyone is here on time. Otherwise, it's very difficult for the speaker to start a session when, you know, introducing a subject and people are coming in and going. So if you could try and make sure, if you're going to attend a lecture, be here on time. Also, you'll notice in the program, it's 4 days of very intense sessions. You may want to pick your sessions. You may not want to attend every single lecture. You're going to have to decide that. If you want to attend every lecture, you may have needed to bring another brain with you, because your brain is going to be pretty fried at the end of it all. So if you consider that, just pick your lectures and come along. But whatever you come to, just remember this one point: please come on time, because we have to start on time and we have to finish on time. Then after lunch, we have To Teach or to Convert, ISKCON and Christianity, with Brother Elred, or Chaitanya Das. He's an initiated devotee and also a Catholic monk. That'd be interesting. And from 6 to 7, we have Vaishnava Training and Education with Rasa Mandal Das. So I'll introduce those as they come. So now, over to Ravindra.
Thank you. I have to stand here. I can't move around a lot, I've been told, so I'm sorry I'll be a little stiff. So I have given an assignment, actually, to talk about, especially Shankarishi's concern that to give devotees some kind of indication of how to deal with going into an academic context and running into professors and academics who are quite competent adherents of a worldview that's different from our own, and how to deal with that without losing one's own convictions in Krishna consciousness. So what I want to do this first talk is, which is entitled Faith and Knowledge, what I want to talk about is what's called epistemology, which means the theory of knowledge. And I want to talk about faith as a component of knowledge and not as something that's opposed to it. I'm going to make a case that faith is the precondition for anybody having any knowledge whatsoever. And so I have to talk about what faith is. When we talk about faith, what I'm going to do is talk about the idea of buddhi, intelligence, because if we look at what's meant by faith, the Sanskrit word is shraddha, and if we look at what we mean by faith and look how Prabhupada describes it, the correct placement of faith is an act of buddhi, of intelligence, or discrimination. So sometimes the idea of faith has been unanalyzed and not very well thought through. And then also I want to talk about another examination of the process of knowledge. This one carried out by Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where he introduces the idea of paradigms and paradigm shifts. Sridhar Swami has done a lot to popularize this idea in ISKCON. And third thing is, I want to talk a little bit about the epistemology of St. Augustine and his doctrine of the primacy of will and knowledge. So you'll see it all fits together. Anyway, those are the three things I hoped, I don't know, by the time we finish here, like we can all get to. But what happens sometimes when we run across academics, or anyone, when I say an academic, I really mean a modern academic, means somebody who really accepts the Enlightenment consensus. They've really bought into the notion, a certain notion of rationality, a certain criterion of truth, a certain belief in progress, a certain faith in what they call science, and so on. I saw a book called Understanding Mantras, written by a collection of essays by academic students of Hinduism, and they said studying mantras presents a particular difficulty for us meaning modern academics, even though they study Hinduism. He said, we have accepted the Enlightenment consensus. We do not believe in magic. Most of us do not pray. And that's the starting point. You know, we do not believe in magic. You know, the idea that you chant certain sounds and they're efficacious is considered magic. And magic means it's somebody else's science that you don't believe in, really. That's what it is. But that's what I mean by an academician. So if we go into that atmosphere representing Krishna consciousness, they'll set up a certain way of looking at things. They'll say, you represent religion, we represent science. You represent faith, we represent knowledge. And there's a whole group of terms that we get labeled with. Faith, religion, or scripture. This Bhagavad Gita will be called a scripture. And we say, yeah, that's a scripture. And we're practicing a religion. We have to be very, very careful about using these terms, because you really buy into a whole view of, just like, what is a scripture? Well, it contrasts to books of knowledge. Scripture is something in which you have faith, where here are these books, which are books of knowledge. It used to be there were actually books of knowledge. Now the books of knowledge are really articles and technical journals. That's what constitutes, I think, what people would call the cutting edge of knowledge. It's become so specialized, nobody writes books like Newton's Principia or something like that. It's not done anymore. But, you know, this is knowledge and this is faith. So this is what we end up against. You know, just to let you know at least how I dealt with this myself, I was a while ago at a meeting convened by Sri Chand Hinduja to this throw around ideas about some kind of center for Vedic studies, and he asked me to attend, and Akundati was there also. Some ISKCON people were there, and also maybe the best Hinduism scholars in the United States were gathered there. Jack Hawley from Columbia, Diana Eck from Harvard. This fellow, Carl Parter, was there, author of Presuppositions of Indians. India's philosophies and so on, like a lot of superstars. And we had to go around the room and introduce who we are and what we were doing. So it came to be my turn, and I really wanted to kind of put my cards on the table. And so I said to them, a funny thing happened to me on my way to getting a PhD in religion. I became a devotee of Krishna. And I just told her I read the Bhagavad Gita, and I was trying to understand it. And in the course of trying to understand it, I became a devotee. I said, both of us study the Vedas, and both of us try to understand what the Vedas are. Nice to know we're still safe, huh? most of us, we try to understand what the Vedas are. We both have our ways of going about understanding the Vedas. You try to understand them and I try to understand them. But when I try to understand the Vedas, I said I look at the final verse of the Svetashvatara Upanishad. And that verse says, they all know this text, I mean, they're all scholars. You know, yasya devi para bhakti tata devi tagaro tasaiti katata hyata prakashan te mahatmanaha. That tells you how to understand. Kapita, all these talks, this is the final verse of the Svetashvatara Upanishad. So it refers to the artha, the meaning, or the purport of all these talks, these discussions, which you have just finished reading. It says, now if you want to understand the meaning of these discussions, prakashante, I mean, if you want the meaning to shine forth, to be manifest, to be luminous, then you have to have parabhakti to the Lord, and as you have to the Lord, so to the Guru. That's the requirement for understanding these texts. I said, no, I read that. And so I said, well, here's the text that tells us how to understand it. And so that's what I do. Now I said, you have a different approach. I said, I come from one tradition. This is what I did. You see, I said, I come from one tradition of knowledge. And that tradition of knowledge says this is how you understand these texts. And I said, I know you have another tradition of knowledge. And I said, I can't quite figure out quite what you're trying to do. I said, I know you're academic students of religion. And I said, and I've sort of become a religious student of academics. And I said, I'm thinking of starting a journal. So I thought that, you know, gave us a kind of a level playing field. And that's what I wanted. I mean, I could do that because I come from a certain background and maybe have certain qualifications. I could talk like that. Maybe everybody else can't. But I want you to try to understand that what you have is not faith versus knowledge, but two different traditions of knowledge. And I would like to make the claim that all processes of knowledge begin in faith. If you want, you study in a university, modern, you know, secular university, and say you're going to study science, right? Knowledge. What's the first thing you do? You walk into a lecture hall, you sit down, you open your notebook, and whatever the guy tells you, you believe. You write it down. That's faith. Immediately they start throwing this whole subject matter at you of things that, for example, if it's a chemistry course, they'll start talking about electrons and protons and neutrons and electron shells and covalent bonds and all these different kinds of things. Things which, by the way, rigorously empirical philosophers call metaphysical entities because they're not directly verifiable. But you believe them. You write them down in your notebook. And you say, now why do you just walk in this room and start listening to a total stranger? Because they have support from the government, the same guy that's flying these jets overhead, right? They're powerful people. That's the establishment. This is a university. It's a recognized university. It's an established university. So you just know already that that's where you learn truth, from this kind of a place. And if you want to inquire any more, well, there's a reputable university. They only hire good professors. And if you really want to doubt, he can show you his credentials. See, here's where I learned chemistry. This is my doctoral dissertation, and so on. Which all shows you that he is, in fact, an accredited member of the community of people that deal in knowledge. And he's an authority. So you trust that authority. You trust that experience of walking in this great big building, and often they're designed just to impress you. They're not low little humble buildings. They're cathedrals. You know, that you've got to feel awe and reverence when you walk in. And so then you believe. So that beginning, that's Shraddha. So our process also, Adho Shraddha. First of all, Shraddha. It begins in Shraddha, faith or confidence. And it used to be, at least, you know, there people from our tradition were at a certain time in a certain culture, it was automatically understood. This is where you go from knowledge. These are the authorized persons. They also had ways of being impressive by physical arrangements and structures and seats and things like that, so that you knew that these are the people that had knowledge. If you begin your course in science, you can challenge from the very outset. You'll say, wait a minute, you're telling me about these molecules and with their electron shells and their charges. How do I know all this stuff is true, this elaborate theoretical structure? And they'll say to you, it's been proven by experiment. We can prove it. I was at least told that science is democratic. That is not anybody can do it. Anybody can perform the experiments. It's open for public verification. So if you're in your freshman chemistry class and you say, well, I want to do it, and they say to you, before you can do the experiments, you have to master the theoretical structure. You won't even know what experiment to do unless you know what it means, or what's a significant experiment, or what that experiment is supposed to show. Otherwise, you may just see some things happening in a test tube. You have no idea what the significance of that is. So before you can do the experiment, first of all, you have to learn the whole theoretical structure. That'll take you, you know, several years. And if you really want to do the experiments, well, you have to go to graduate school. We don't let anybody near this equipment. It's expensive stuff. You have to be well trained. And then if you start to find out who it is that actually does the experiment, there's a few guys. Very few people. Like just right now, where quantum physics is happening and stuff like that, there's maybe two dozen people that actually can do the, maybe three or four people do the experiments, maybe two dozen people actually understand it, and everybody else accepts it on faith. Because there's a certain social structure, and there's a certain power structure, and there's this, you know, and everybody understands whatever these people produce, that's knowledge. And everyone reads it in Time or Newsweek or whatever, and they believe it. And most scientists, they don't do the experiments, they believe it too. So, this isn't to say that what they produce isn't knowledge. It may be. In fact, we can say it is knowledge, because that tradition defines what counts as knowledge. They decide this is what counts as knowledge. Those same people have decided that what we say counts as knowledge doesn't count as knowledge. Although if you look at it again, we have a similar procedure. In fact, Prabhupada uses the word science to describe Krishna consciousness. We have a book that's called The Science of Self-Realization. Now, Lipton put it down as one of his signs of a mind control organization or whatever that they use. They expropriate the prestige of science by using the word. But the word science is much older than science. Like Thomas Aquinas said, that theology is the queen of the sciences. It wasn't a cult. Science means knowledge. That's all. And Prabhupada specifically uses the word science to translate a certain Sanskrit word. there's two words. They show up all the time, jnana and vijnana. So jnana means, actually Prabhupada says about Krishna consciousness, and he's thinking of these two words when he says it, although in this statement he doesn't refer to them explicitly. He says that knowledge, which is jnana, means information that is contained in the Vedas. And it is scientific because it is realized by the candidate's own experience. Scientific, he means vijnana. In fact, Sanskrit is, whenever they translate science into Sanskrit, I'm talking about modern material science, they use this word, vijnana. Because in Prabhupada, the word realization, realized knowledge, is vijnana. So jnana means theoretical, and vijnana means practical or experiential. And the claim is about Krishna consciousness that makes it scientific is not only are there things we read about in the Vedas, like the soul, like the absolute truth, having three features and so on, which are doctrines that we will accept in the beginning on faith, but it's expected by engaging in the practices of Krishna consciousness that one will eventually acquire realized knowledge or vijnana, by which these things are... we don't just want to understand theoretically that we're not our bodies. We want to live that way. We want to experience ourselves that way. We want to become liberated. That's vijnana. So this is a process. Krishna consciousness is a process for the development of prema. And it begins, ado shraddha, first of all shraddha. There's a sequence. There's steps, one after another. A rational sequence of development. One thing leads to another, that first of all there is Shraddha. This is Rupa Goswami's verse from Nectar of Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu. First of all, Shraddha. Some preliminary interest or commitment, faith, that there's something here. Then because of that, sadhasanga, one will associate with spiritual people. Because of that, that leads to bhajana kriya, acceptance of a path of spiritual discipline under guidance, which leads to anartha nirvritti, the removal of unwanted things from the heart, which leads to nishta, one becomes steady, which leads to ruchi, taste for Krishna conscious, asakti, addiction to Krishna or to the activities of Krishna consciousness. Then bhava, ecstasy, and prema. This is the sequence. He calls it a krama. Krama means chronological order or sequence of stages in the development of prema in the candidate. We know this. So one thing, next thing, next thing, next thing, next thing. And we can say this can go wrong, that can go wrong. If this isn't happening, what's wrong here? If anartha nirvritti is taking place, we know why. We know what are the conditions under which it can take place, or what will inhibit it, and how to rectify it. These are all things that people have been through this path. They have developed prema, and this is the sequence. We follow that path correctly, and we also can see that it is working. So that's a process of knowledge. It's a scientific process. And it begins in faith. So in this way, it doesn't differ in any way, except as to what's important, as to what the end goal is, from any other process of knowledge. And you may say, well, you say this based on your faith, and maybe there's a handful of people that actually attain prema, and everybody else just believes them. But it's the same situation. You can say that maybe, you know, quantum physics is done by a handful of adepts, and everybody else accepts them on faith. You could make that, but we can say we also say this is democratic in the sense that anybody can engage in the process. And you say, well, I don't know if I want to believe, you say it's there, and I want to verify it by my own experience, but what you have here takes at least, 7 to 12 years or something. And Well, so what does it take to get a doctorate degree in chemistry? So I don't see that there's any structural difference between these two processes of knowledge, except what counts as an act of knowledge, what counts as investigation, what you're after, what territory you're exploring, these kinds of things. So that's why we can say this is a tradition of knowledge. And we define what knowledge is and what constitutes realized knowledge. We have a right to do that, just like modern science. They'll tell you this is what knowledge is. It has to be verified by your... For a statement to be scientifically meaningful, some possible sense experience has to be at least capable of falsifying it. That's one criterion for scientific meaningfulness. It's falsifiable by sense experience. Now, we're interested in finding out about God. Atasi Krishna Nama Deet Nabe Vidvat Grayam Indraat. Your sense experience is useless. Your materially contaminated senses will not be able to apprehend Krishna's name, form, and so on. That's a fact. But, we say, if those senses are purified by being engaged in acts of devotion, then they will be able to apprehend Krishna. That's what he says. We say our senses are originally meant for experiencing God. Because they've been engaged in the acts of sense gratification, they become incapacitated and incompetent. If we restore them to their original function by devotional service, then again, Krishna can be apprehended. And in that way, existentially verified. That's our claim. And you want to follow it up? Go ahead. Now, somebody will say, well, in order to do this, I have to believe it in the beginning. Yes, you do. And in the same way, if you want to do chemistry or you do physics, you have to believe it in the beginning, too. That same commitment is required. Otherwise, you can't even make sense of what's going on. So now I want to talk a little bit more about this idea of faith and what it is. Because what Krishna consciousness we have to see is about the placement of faith in Krishna. And there's actually, it's not just that faith is blind. Prabhupada has said before, people should not have blind faith. It's not wanted. Because just like reason can err, so faith can be misplaced. So there has to be some system for the intelligent placement of faith. What is that? How do we go about it? So, if we look at, there's an interesting discussion in the Bhagavad Gita where the idea of faith and the idea of intelligence are linked together. In 241, Vyavasa Atmika Buddhya, a.k.a. Guru Nandana, what Krishna is describing is what he calls Buddhi Yoga, the linking process or the discipline of Buddhi, of intelligence. Now, by the way, Prabhupada has described Bhagavad Gita as being on the platform of Buddhi, of intelligence. He describes four levels of culture, I think in a pamphlet, on chanting Hare Krishna maybe. Some simple document. Prabhupada describes the culture of the body, the culture of the mind, the culture of intelligence, and the culture of the soul proper. Four levels of culture. He said the culture of the body are those places where it's just available for gross sense gratification. Restaurants, hotels, bars, nightclubs, health spas, and so on. This is the culture of the body. Then the culture of the mind takes place in colleges and universities where people are throwing up various topics for their mental speculation. Someone puts a theory up, everybody gets into it, they follow it for a while, they get sick of it, They take it down, they put up a new theory, everybody does that for a while, and they get sick of it, and they go a new one. And you find actually that in general, intellectual life follows fads just like fashions. Clothes go back and forth. They come into fashion and go out of fashion. This is the culture of the mind. He said the culture of the intelligence is Bhagavad Gita. Because the effort of the Bhagavad Gita is to use intelligence in its ultimate function of surrendering to Krishna. When intelligence is successfully developed, buddhi is successfully developed, then there is surrender to Krishna. And finally, having surrendered to Krishna, one can enter the culture of the soul proper, which is Srimad Bhagavatam. Because Bhagavad Gita ends, Krishna says, sarva dharmam parityaja mamekam saranam bhaja, give up all different dharmas and surrender to me. And Bhagavatam begins, dharma projita kaitavotra paramo. Now that you have given up all these different materialistically motivated dharmas. So that's why it says that where Bhagavad Gita ends, Srimad Bhagavatam begins. So Prabhupada said Bhagavad Gita is culture of intelligence and Bhagavatam is the culture of the soul proper. So the Bhagavad Gita is on the platform of buddhi. Now we know that we have this division in the subtle body, the Vedic psychology, manas. Manas, buddhi, ahankara. These are the three subtle elements that make up the sukshma sarira, the subtle body. And then above that, sometimes the fourth is there. Chitta, here meaning consciousness, or sometimes called contaminated consciousness. Each of these is presided over by chitta by Vasudev, ahankara by Shankarshan, buddhi by Aniruddha, one by Aniruddha and one by Prajumna, I forgot which. Anyway, the Chaturvyuha, this is all described in this by Kapila Dev. So this is what is our interior life, has these levels. And this is very, very precise. Manas, mind, the function of the mind is to accept and reject things in terms of sense gratification. Sankalpa and vikalpa. Generally, like the mind, when something feels good, it goes for it, and if it feels bad, it withdraws. That's accepting and rejecting. If we just stay, if there's just manas and no buddhi, we're doomed, because many things we have to do require overriding the mind. Whenever the mind is, there's an overriding function, that's when buddhi kicks in. Now, like for example, you can see if I've been given some medicine to take that's bitter, and I put it in my mouth, my first impulse is to go, bam, and spit it out. That's the mind reacting. But if I have received instructions, I know that for my long-term health and so on, I have to take this medicine anyway, and so therefore I swallow it, that buddhi has kicked in and overruled the mind. And this is how buddhi works like that. So you see, like children, for example, who have no intelligence, their parents have to be their intelligence. They have to force them to take it. And then gradually they internalize the voice of their parents, and their intelligence becomes more and more strengthened. So that because of intelligence, we can engage in disciplined long-term activities. The little child goes across the room, is totally mind, and gets distracted here and gets distracted there and never makes it to the other side. They have what's known as a short attention span. And one function of buddhi is attention. Buddhi is what focuses attention. And we, some of us in earlier days have had the same experience. You take certain chemicals like marijuana. It destroys the buddhi, and you become just like a little child, and you can't perform long-term sequential activities. You get hung up or spaced out, and never get from one end of the room to the other. This is there are other functions of buddhi that are described here by Kapila Dev. He says the functions of buddhi: doubt, misapprehension, correct apprehension, memory, sleep. And Prabhupada says here that, the functions of intelligence are to help in ascertaining the nature of objects when they come into view, and to help the senses. You see, the senses means the knowledge acquiring senses. The knowledge acquiring senses are backed up by buddhi, just like the active senses are backed up by prana. Because of prana, the life force, the hands, the legs, and so on operate. And the knowledge-acquiring senses operate because of buddhi. Ascertain the nature of objects when they come into view. In other words, the phenomena of recognition is the function of buddhi. And this is where you can see buddhi operating when you do look at these various sorts of experiments they put forward in Gestalt psychology. You know, my favorite one, I didn't bring it with me, but I had this thing I got from the philosopher Wittgenstein of the duck rabbit. It's this little figure, and you look at it and you'll see a duck or you can see a rabbit. There's two little lobes. I don't think I can draw it successfully right now, but there are two little lobes going down, which are either the ears of a rabbit facing this way or the bill of a duck facing that way. And if you look at it, you'll see a duck or you'll see a rabbit. And you can kind of flick back and forth between duck, rabbit, duck, rabbit. So what is it when you look at something and you see something like a duck or a rabbit? And what's fascinating is that you see buddhi operating. Or the same thing of, you see two lines, there's a dark middle and these two wavy lines. And depending on what's the background and what's the foreground, you'll either see two profile of two people looking at each other, or you see a vase on a light background. And again, it's hard to see both at the same time. You'll see one or the other. This is the kind of experiments they do in Gestalt psychology. So that is what the function of buddhi is. Or you can see, it's an interesting thing, you may have had the experience, somebody's coming towards you, there's a face, and you're looking at that face, then you get this little notion, this face is familiar, and then suddenly, you recognize that person. It's the same datum on your eyeball or whatever, but all of a sudden you recognize them. And as though something changed, although their perception is the same. This is buddhi. So buddhi very much helps categorize and organize our experience. Now, we don't experience blotches of color, we experience identifiable things that have names, that we give names to, and that fit into certain patterns. We have categories, and we experience in terms of these categories. And so that whole categorical scheme in which our experience fits into, I guess you could call it a mindset, that is determined by buddhi. And sometimes we undergo changes where our whole mindset, a way of experiencing things, changes. That's what Kuhn calls a paradigm shift. Those kinds of changes happen on the platform of buddhi, of intelligence. So that's what he says. So misapprehension, correct apprehension. Memory, because memory is tied in with this function of recognition. And doubt also, that I don't know what something is, can't understand it. All these things are, this is what is described as the specific functions of lakshana, characteristics of intelligence. So the idea of the intelligence is a complicated thing. And it's very difficult to understand because it can't be understood on the mental platforms. You have to get up to the intellectual platform. So anyway, here in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is talking about, he introduces this notion of Buddhi Yoga, which Prabhupada sometimes translates just as Krishna consciousness or as activities in Krishna consciousness. And especially he's talking about Vyavasa Atmika Buddhi. Those people who have who are resolute in purpose, those are Krishna conscious, their aim is one, Ekeha. They only have one thing in this world. And Krishna contrasts it with other people who have splayed intelligence, Bahushanka, those whose buddhi or intelligence is many-branched. Those who are on this path of Buddhi Yoga are resolute in purpose and their aim is one. They only want one thing. The intelligence of those who are irresolute is many-branched. So Prabhupada says in the purport, a strong faith that by Krishna consciousness one will be elevated to the highest perfection of life is called Vyavasa Atmika, intelligence. So here he defines intelligence as faith, which is really interesting, because we're always thinking of faith as something that's sort of stupid. But here he describes it as intelligence. And he quotes the definition of faith from Chaitanya Charitamrita. If you don't know this, it's Majjhalila 2262, where there's a very precise definition of Shraddha that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gives. He says that Shraddha is the firm conviction that Krishna Bhakti Koyale Sarva Karma Kritta Hoy, that by accomplishing or executing, completing Krishna consciousness, Sarva Karma Kritta Hoy, everything else will be taken care of. In other words, in order to be resolute in purpose and to have a single aim in life, one has to have the conviction that if I attain Krishna consciousness, I will be satisfied and everybody will be satisfied. Everything will be fulfilled in all other departments. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in support of this, then quotes that Bhagavatam verse that says, by pouring water on the root of the tree, all the leaves and branches are watered, and by giving food to the prana, all the limbs of the body are satisfied. So, in other words, in order to have this resolute purpose, Vyavasa Atmika Buddhi, this fixed intelligence, I have to have this idea that, or this conviction somehow or other, that Krishna consciousness is the only thing I need. And that if I have Krishna consciousness, everything else will be satisfied. And then specifically, what Krishna is trying to do in this chapter is divert Arjuna, convert him from one position to another. Because then he talks about Veda Vadarata. Those people who think they understand the Vedas but really don't. They perform various sacrifices for bhoga and aishvarya, for sense gratification and opulent life. And then Krishna says, but in those people who are attracted to bhoga and aishvarya, this Vyavasa Atmika Buddhi does not occur. Does not take place. You got too many different things you want. I need a car, I need this, I need that, I gotta have this, I gotta have that. So you're splayed out all over the place. But in order to be able to be successful in Krishna consciousness, you have to be single-minded. Your aim is one. You notice this is, by the way, been considered to be a defect in devotees. It's not balanced. It's monomaniacal. It's another thing that cults, you know, you just are interested in one thing. Your life isn't balanced. But you'll notice that when people are doing after goals that people approve of, like winning a gold medal in the skating competition in the Olympics, that single-mindedness of purpose is extolled as a wonderful thing. See, they've sacrificed everything for this. They practice all the time. They're heroes. if they've done that or they to win a Nobel Prize in science, something the culture says is good and valuable, then they say, wow, I wish I could do like that. I can't. I lack the discipline. I lack the drive. It's only when it's something that they don't like Krishna consciousness, that don't recognize the value of, then they say, oh, well, this is bad news. You must be brainwashed. Your life is imbalanced. Why don't you spend a little more time in the movies or with your dogs or whatever? But actually, to achieve anything difficult requires, even if you're postponing sense gratification, which is usually what people are doing, they say, I suffer now so I can enjoy later. Now I go to school and I stand up late at night over the Bunsen burner while all my friends are off in the bars and stuff. So I sacrifice now. Later, you know, I'll have my degree and they won't, and I'll have a bigger salary than they will, or whatever. I'll have achieved more. So just to do that, anything, to achieve anything difficult, it requires discipline, self-discipline, postponement of various sorts of gratifications, and so on. That's what's called being responsible. So what we try to do in Krishna consciousness is something that's very difficult. Much easier to be a rocket scientist, because as Prabhupada said, you can see who are the cultural heroes, the people who have conquered the world, like Caesar or somebody, and still falls victim to Cleopatra because he can't control his senses. It says real heroism is to actually be able to control one's senses, to be able to be not victimized by material desires. So this is what Krishna is trying to convince Arjuna to take up. And you notice his arguments are really not, they're very persuasive arguments. But what he does for Arjuna in this chapter is put up a certain ideal person that Arjuna should admire, a sage of steady mind. And he describes him in detail. What such a person is like, and in contrast to those men of small knowledge who are attached to the flowery words of the Vedas and say there is nothing more than this, he describes the sage of steady mind. One who is not disturbed in mind even amid the threefold miseries, or elated where there is happiness, who is free from attachment, fear, and anger, is called a sage of steady mind. In the material world, one who is unaffected by whatever good or evil may be obtained, neither praising it nor despising it, is firmly fixed in perfect knowledge. And all these are really synonyms, prajna, another synonym for having developed buddhi or intelligence. One who is able to withdraw his senses from sense objects as the tortoise draws its limbs within the shell is firmly fixed in perfect consciousness, prajna pratishta. One who restrains his senses, keeping them under full control, and fixes his consciousness upon me is known as a man of steady intelligence. Anyway, this way he explains this kind of a person to Arjuna, which finds very, very attractive. And then he culminates this description by this very interesting verse. This is 269. What is night for all beings is the time of awakening for the self-controlled, and the time of awakening for all beings is night for the introspective sage. So he's saying now that one who has developed this buddhi and has gone in a certain way lives in a different world from other people. What this person that Arjuna is describing sees, his categories of experiences, the experience they have, they're different experiences from those people who are, what does he call them here? Yes, oh, he says all beings, those who are not self-controlled. They live in two different worlds. Of course, Prabhupada had a lecture on this, which was distributed as an early pamphlet called Who is Crazy? They say we're crazy and we say they're crazy. So what happens when what I want to say is that this development of Krishna consciousness, this act of buddhi, by which one develops along a certain path, things get transvalued. What happens is, what people say is good becomes bad. For example, like yehi samsparsaja bhoga dukkha yonai evate. You have a different evaluation. Those pleasures which arise between the contact between their senses and the object, they're the source of all suffering, Krishna says. So what becomes good becomes bad. What bad becomes good. So the whole way that you, there's a transvaluation of values that takes place when there's Krishna consciousness. So all these things, this is done by buddhi. One makes a decision. And this making of a decision, what Krishna is trying to get Arjuna is to make a certain sort of commitment. This is another word for buddhi, is commitment. Decision, determination, intelligence has the notion of willpower attached to it also. So as you see, when we go, the function of intelligence, there's an ordinary function. Everybody has to have it, have intelligence functioning, just in order for there to be sense perception. But sometimes there are changes that are extraordinary changes, changes in frames of reference. You can call them conversions. Now, what is a conversion? It's such a total reevaluation of fundamentals, or a rejection of one set of fundamental assumptions and taking up another set. But you live in a different world afterwards than you did before. That's what takes place on the platform of buddhi. Just like here in 269, people see different things, they live in different worlds, and so on. So what's happened, the difference that between, say, devotees of Krishna and a modern academic who has accepted the enlightenment consensus, is a difference on this very fundamental platform of buddhi. They do not recognize, it will be hard to find recognize what we do as knowledge. Not when you really come down to it. And the same thing, what is said about that so-called knowledge. You know, see how I have to put the word so-called in front of it, right? Because I've been trained. So-called knowledge. Knowledge that arises from sense perception. So, this is what's really taking place. There's a study of this this kind of thing, which I'll get into more, I guess, the next talk, where Thomas Kuhn came out with this book. I think it came out in the early 60s. I was actually in school when it came out, and it was pretty revolutionary. He is a historian of science, and it was his investigation that, contrary to what science believed of itself, that it's progress by the steady, rational accumulation of knowledge, that there were in the history of science what he called here revolutions, where one way of doing science is ditched and a whole other way is taken up again. When, you know, the phlogiston theory of, for chemistry is abandoned and the atomic theory of Dalton is taken up. And these he calls paradigm shifts. Of course, a paradigm means a model, a standard way of doing things. But for paradigm within science, what happens in science is you deal with observable data. But in order to make sense of it and link it together, you put it into a theoretical scheme. You have different things happening, but you say, for example, you have theories about electricity, which is like a flow of ions. Now, nobody sees an ion. They see you know, you can see like a little globe. You can rub a glass with some sheep's wool or something, and then it'll pick up pieces of paper. That's all you see. Then to explain this, you have a theory about positive and negative charges and ions and things like that. Nobody's seen an ion. Well, before there was that, there was another theory about where electricity was thought of as some kind of liquid that flowed or something else. You know, there were different sorts of ideas. So when these very fundamental sorts of theories change, he calls a paradigm. He says, paradigm initial meaning is universally recognized scientific achievements that for a time provide model problems and solutions to a community of practitioners. I mean, the notion of community is essential in this notion of paradigms shifts. So he says, when there was some scientific achievement, he said it defines the legitimate problems and methods of a research field for succeeding generations of practitioners. It became paradigms. Not only does it define what you do, but it says, this is what is an important problem. This is what we want to solve. In other words, it decides what's important and what's not important. What constitutes a problem, what doesn't constitute a problem. How do you decide that on a rational basis? What decides it is what you're really interested in, for whatever reason you may be interested in. And again, what you're interested in, what interests you, is a determination of buddhi. So he's talking about this, these successful paradigms of doing science. He says he wants to suggest that accepted examples of actual scientific practice, examples which include law, theory, application, and instrumentation together. See, it's one package. It's not just people thinking theoretically. It's the way you sit down and do things, what kind of apparatus you have on your desk, and so on. Provide models from which spring particular, coherent traditions of scientific research. The study of paradigms is what mainly prepares the student for membership in the particular scientific community with which he will later practice. So this is the notion that he has of paradigms that goes on here. And then he discusses these. At certain times, a crisis will develop. Somehow or other, your particular scientific paradigm is able to deal pretty good with most things, but everybody gets, well, sometimes anomalies develop, things that happen that you just can't deal with or account for with your particular paradigm. Well, the first thing you do is you say, well, we'll put it aside. We won't worry about this now. It works pretty good for everything else as an anomaly. Maybe we'll figure it out later. So you put it in the anomaly closet. A crisis may develop when the anomaly closet finally bursts over and there's just too many of them. And then finally you have to pay attention to them. And then everybody says something is wrong. But Kuhn points out scientists will not give up one paradigm unless there is another paradigm that somehow or other accounts for these anomalies, they think, more successfully than before. Then you'll see a paradigm shift. But most frequently, what happens is not even that so many people change. The people that accept the new paradigm are young people just getting into the field. And the old guys die off. Once somebody has achieved some success working with the old paradigm, they don't change. It's too much to handle. And people who already have no commitment, or not very much commitment to the old paradigm, are the ones that take it off. And that's how progress is made. Very few people actually change on that fundamental a level. And usually the way they have been taught by the established authorities in their youth is the way they stick to it. until the bitter end. So when there's a crisis, and he describes a crisis, he says the transition from a paradigm in crisis to a new one, from which a new tradition of normal science can emerge, is far from a cumulative process, one achieved by an articulation or extension of the old paradigm. Rather, it is a reconstruction of the field from new fundamentals, a reconstruction that changes some of the field's most elementary theoretical generalizations, as well as many of its paradigm methods and applications. When the transition is complete, the profession will have changed its view of the field, its method, and its goals. One perceptive historian, viewing a classic case of a scientist's reorientation by paradigm change, recently described it as picking up the other end of the stick, a process that involves handling the same bundle of data as before, but placing them in a new system of relations with one another by giving them a different framework. Others who have noted this aspect of scientific advance have emphasized its similarity to a change in visual gestalt. I've already talked about that. That kind of, when you see a different thing in the same pattern. The marks on the paper that were first seen as a bird are now seen as an antelope, or vice versa. That parallel can be misleading. Scientists do not see something as something else. Instead, they simply see it. When you look at a duck rabbit or something, you know there's something there that you can interpret two ways. When a scientist is dealing with reality, there's just the reality. He doesn't know that there's some neutral position or point of view. But the comparison with the gestalt, at least from my point of view, it works very well because both are functions of intelligence. When you recognize something on a very fundamental perceptual level, like recognizing this as this or that, when you see a snake as a rope and that kind of thing, that's a function of intelligence. But it's also a function of intelligence when your whole world view is set in a certain way, and once in a while, usually people only go through this once in their lifetimes, they change it. And that's certainly, like, when I look at my experience of becoming a devotee of Krishna, It was very much like what Kun describes. Because Kun says there's certain things about these paradigm switches that are characteristic of them. He calls them conversions. He describes them like as conversions. Because there's a certain thing that happens. He revolutions means he compares them to a revolution in politics. And what happens when a revolution in politics takes place is you can't solve your problems anymore. He says here, political revolutions aim to change political institutions in ways that those institutions themselves prohibit. Their success, therefore, necessitates the partial relinquishment of one set of institutions in favor of another. And in the interim, society is not fully governed by institutions at all. This is a political revolution. So there's a crisis. Then as the crisis deepens, many individuals commit themselves to some concrete proposal for the reconstruction of society in a new institutional framework. At that point, the society is divided into competing camps or parties. And in science, when there's a paradigm shift, the guy, one group's holding down one journal, another group's holding down another journal, and they're fighting at each other at conferences like crazy, and they're anathematizing each other, and they're heretics. And it's no longer the rational process within normal science, because nobody knows what the rules are anymore. So like politics, society is divided into competing camps or parties, one seeking to defend the old institutional constellation, the other seeking to institute some new one. And once that polarization has occurred, political recourse fails. Because they differ about the institutional matrix within which political change is to be achieved and evaluated, because they acknowledge no super-institutional framework for the adjudication of revolutionary differences. The parties to a revolutionary conflict must finally resort to the techniques of mass persuasion, often including force. This is what happens in a revolution. Now, he says that when there's this paradigm shift in science, argument in one sense fails because there's not even enough agreement on fundamentals to have a rational discussion. And we'll see the same thing when you deal with somebody, say, who accepts the Enlightenment, you know, process, consensus. There's not even enough agreement on fundamentals to have a rational discussion. As he describes this, there's a debate going on about paradigm choices, right? He says when paradigms enter into a debate about paradigm choice, their role is necessarily circular. Each group uses its own paradigm to argue in that paradigm's defense. The resulting circularity does not make the argument wrong or even ineffectual. The man whose premise is a paradigm when arguing in its defense can nonetheless provide a clear exhibit of what scientific practice will be like for those who adapt to the new view of nature. That exhibit can be immensely persuasive, often compellingly so. Yet whatever its force, the status of the circular argument is only that of persuasion. It cannot be made logically or even probabilistically compelling for those who refuse to step into the circle. The premise and the value shared by the two parties to a debate over paradigms are not sufficiently extensive for that. As in political revolution, so in paradigm choice, there is no standard higher than the assent of the relevant community. So, for example, I noticed like when I began to think about becoming a devotee of Krishna, and on the one side there was a kind of combination of modern Enlightenment way of looking about things fused with Mayavad philosophy. That was the sort of paradigm I was working out of. And then there was Krishna consciousness, which was so completely different. And I noticed that I could not give any grounds for becoming a devotee of Krishna which did not already presume Krishna consciousness. Because all grounds were at stake. The same for not becoming a devotee. It was the same way. Just the decision, you know, that the highest goal of life is self-realization. On what do you justify that? You can just start saying, well, when you become self-realized, you're no longer subject to material miseries and so on like that, which already presupposes the whole system of thought by which self-realization is the highest goal. And if you want to go the other side about, say, sense gratification, you already... And what's persuasive about somebody who's an advocate of sense gratification is just the conviction which they say, you know, you guys got your heads, you know, you don't know what's going on. How can you be so dumb? When somebody says that with conviction, then you say, oh, I feel a doubt. That's not a rational argument. So what you have are competing paradigms. There's not even enough in common. So I realized that here I was when I wanted to become a devotee. There was this particular naked sort of a choice for either Krishna was God or Krishna wasn't God. And if I accepted Krishna as God, then all the reasons for accepting Krishna were already contained in that choice. I accepted Krishna as God. Why? Well, on the authority of the Vedas. Well, why do I accept the authority of the Vedas? Because I've already accepted Krishna as God, and so on. You get caught in the circle, and it all works out. And that's when I realized, you know, when there was a certain leap of faith that was involved. It was an act of faith. On the other hand, what I realized is people who didn't become devotees of Krishna were also making a leap of faith. Most of them didn't even know it. Because the basis for a materialistic way of life is equally circular and self-contained and so on. And so it was when I went back and reread Kuhn, here he was talking about the same sorts of things. In fact, he mentions here looking at when there's a scientific revolution, he says that the issue is which paradigm should in the future guide research on problems, many of which neither competitor can yet claim to resolve completely. A decision between alternate ways of practicing science is called for, and in the circumstances that decision must be based less on past achievement than on future promise. The man who embraces a new paradigm at an early stage must often do so in defiance of the evidence provided by problem solving. He must, that is, have faith that the new paradigm will succeed with many large problems that confront it, knowing only that the older paradigm has failed with a few. A decision of that kind can only be made on faith. So there is the role of faith. The big pioneers, they basically had faith. If you look and see how much evidence they actually had, it was very skimpy, easy to put down. You could find ways, but somehow or other they were particularly obsessed individuals who had this intuition that that things would get that way. He also wants to point out that paradigms define what constitutes a problem. And sometimes when there's a paradigm shift, things that were thought to be big problems that science had to solve are no longer considered to be worthwhile thinking about. Nobody can solve them still, but they're just not important anymore. Other things become more important. So what determines importance? What determines interest? These are all decisions based on buddhi. So I just want to finish up with one last thing. That's kind of a quick tour through Kuhn. St. Augustine talked about what he called the primacy of the will in knowledge. And he points out that we do not know anything unless we are at first interested in it. And the more we're interested, the more we find out about it. And interest, when it becomes most comprehensive or most intense, is called love. So that he says knowledge really depends upon love. Specifically, he's talking about knowledge of God. As St. Augustine points out, he says there can be knowledge without acknowledgement, or cognition without recognition. In other words, the datum can be right in front of you, but if you're not interested or you're not looking for it, you won't see it. There can be cognition without recognition. And Prabhupada gives an example like that. Somebody says, did you see the President of the United States? He was right in front of you. No, I didn't see him. Because what? I didn't recognize him. So similarly, for a devotee who is developed in a certain way, we can see God everywhere. We can see Krishna everywhere and everything. We recognize him all the time. For somebody else, that datum just isn't there. And from our point of view, it's a willful ignorance. They've developed that opposite mentality. Bhagavatam has a verse, Viparya Asmitihi, Asmiti, Viparya Asmiti. They have developed this opposite conception. You know, the living entity has come to the material world precisely in order not to see Krishna. And therefore Krishna disappears from view. When the devotee again wants to see Krishna, Krishna appears. Where does that come from? Mata smitya jnanam apohanam cha. That's Krishna talking about himself as the super soul. From me comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. Apohana means not seeing, shoving aside. That's the function of intelligence. And Krishna directs the intelligence in that way, the buddhi, so that one can see or not see as the living entity desires. So anyway, this is St. Augustine recognized the same phenomena. So he's talking about why some people saw God and some people didn't see God. Because some people are interested and some people are not interested. It's the determination of the will. And so you will, what is known ultimately is what is loved. And that's what we come to find out. So that ultimate determination of the intelligence is either finally rest, according to Bhagavad Gita. See, I have to do this within our framework, right? According to Bhagavad Gita, it either goes toward Krishna or toward against Krishna. And, you know, the enlightenment consensus or whatever, is there's a certain decision that was made against Krishna and a certain tradition following from it. And it's developed in that way. It's become coherent. It's become articulate. It's got its defenders and so on. And that's one way. We're going in a different direction. So naturally, there's two different worlds. Anyway, one needs to say, at least we should understand, it's not a question of this is faith and that's knowledge. But is it just two different ways, two different traditions, which have developed according to the determination of buddhi or intelligence? And as far as we're concerned, that's the decision of the jiva, which way he wants to go, one way or the other. So when you encounter an academic who is following the procedures of modern science and really believes in it and so on, that's what's happening. So I'll leave some few minutes for questions and comments. Yeah.
Thank you, Reverend. Nice to
have you talk. You're welcome.
You spoke about. Can you hear
me? Yeah, I can hear you. I don't know if there's, I don't know how to move this microphone around, but go ahead. I'll try to repeat your question.
You spoke about two systems of knowledge, which are very different, which seem to exclude each other. Or a little bit like, to use Krishna's analogy, like night and day, which reminded me of a comment which I've sometimes heard, that one of the great weaknesses in today's world is that it's divided into a secular world and a religious world. And the two can't really relate to each other. For example, I might be an academic or a scientist, and during the week, I might be working according to the Enlightenment consensus.
Mm-hmm. And then on Sunday, you become a born-again Baptist.
Very sincere sort of member of a religious group.
That's right.
So it seems like this separation is actually, ultimately, it's a great weakness in today's society. Is there not some way of, positing a sort of a holistic synthesis that allows me, as a religionist, to give value to what is of value in the scientist, for example, and vice versa?
Well, I guess you want, the holistic synthesis. In a way, I would say that Krishna consciousness does that, ultimately, because it doesn't devalue material things. What you really get that's difficult to me is various sorts of philosophies that propound an absolute dualism between the spiritual and the material. I had a Ismail al-Faruqi who taught Islamic thinking and theology at my university, said that there's two worlds. There's the material world, which is mundane, secular, completely matter, no way divine, and then there's the divine world, and they've only come together one place and one time, that's the Quran, and otherwise they're just different, That was his way of dealing with it. Or I think Mayavad philosophy, if you ask in Mayavad philosophy, what is the relationship between Brahman and the material world, there isn't any. They're two completely different things. They have no relationship. If you want to say there's some other paradigm that includes its subcategories, Krishna consciousness and, some other materialistic thing, well, I guess you have to come up with it and then be a prophet and persuade us all to undergo some paradigm shift like that. Yeah, but you'll find out that some of the things that I would like to say this, that a theory can work on a laboratory level and produce things, and not be true in the ultimate sense. I mean, I really accept a kind of instrumentalist view of theories. But, you know, the phlogiston theory, for example, quite accurately predicted a whole number of phenomena and worked really well up to a point. And I think most of the theories will go that way also. So Prabhupada's notion, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, my point of view, is the theory that Krishna consciousness gives is given by Krishna. And therefore it's got an advantage over every other theory that it's produced by the person who really knows what's going on. I suspect, at least what Prabhupada tells us, is that that if people took it seriously, scientists took it seriously, he said there's many hints for future research in there. At least that's the way I'm going. The notion that anytime there's two paradigms or three or four, that the way to go is to find some higher synthesis. Because if there's automatically a conflict, they can't be the ultimate truth. I don't know if that's the case. It could be that one is right and one is wrong. And the sort of presupposition that everybody is somehow rather right, and we're all going to get together by having the framework which includes all frameworks. I don't know if that's so. Sometimes people are just wrong. That's been known to happen. So if you come up with it, I guess you'll have a higher synthesis of somebody anywhere. By the way, one last thing on the matter of synthesis. In describing his metaphysics, Alfred North Whitehead says, the many become one and are increased by one. And that applies to all attempts to synthesize religion. People are bothered by religious pluralism or differentiation. You know, they don't like it, but they think that somehow religion should be one. And so here's somebody, and they see Muslims and Hindus, and then they have a vision of a transcendent unity. And so then that's expressed as the Sikh religion. And so where now you had two, now you have three. Or you get Baha'i, or the Unification Church. So this is all these attempts at trying to solve the problem of religious diversity by creating the unified religion. It follows this dictum of Whitehead, so many become one and are increased by one. So, I just noticed that phenomena, so I don't think that's the way to go. Anyway, I have to quit. Shonika Rishi says, I don't have 10:30 yet, I have 1 minute left. Okay, we have to stop. But we can ask more questions next time, because these talks are kind of sliding into each other. Thank you very much.
Okay, the next talk is at 11:45 sharp. Okay, if you could all be back in here at 11:45, whoever wants to attend. Thank you.
What is the reference you're doing from the Bible?
Oh, those? Those were, yeah. That's in 3:26, 29, and 30.
What paradigm?
The paradigm about paradigms?
The paradigm of the enlightenment of things. They're saying that's finished, right?
Some people are. There's a lot of people that are saying it's not. You know, they're fighting a heavy rear guard action, if that's what it is. Yeah, it's not.
They're saying everything's just transient, right? Is it something like that? The postmodern condition?
Yeah. Postmodern is... They want to say that there's something, there's something to Native American religions and things like that, but nobody really knows what it is, It's just this kind of sentiment that we got to go beyond the enlightenment, we got to go postmodern. I don't know where to go.
I haven't looked deeply into it.